Okay, for those who are new to Champaka Buddhist Lodge and also attending Ajahn Brahm's talk for the first time, allow me to introduce to you Ajahn Brahm's background. Ajahn Brahmavamsa was born in London in 1951. He came from a working class background but won a scholarship to Cambridge, graduating with a master's degree in theoretical physics. He became disillusioned because he felt that this great scientist knew everything about the universe out there but nothing about their own minds. Having been interested in Buddhism since age 17, he wished to deepen his commitment and decided to go to Thailand because Thai monks smiled more. At the age of 23, he received ordination and trained for several years before the renowned meditation teacher, Ajahn Chah. In 1983, he was invited to Perth by the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. He is now the abbot of Bodhinyana Buddhist Monastery, which is recognized internationally as one of the world's premier monastic institutions. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome Ajahn Brahm and his talk titled today, Mindfulness. Thank you.
Okay, I have to put this right in my mouth, I think, before people can hear me in the back. Can you hear me in the back? Very good. Today's talk is about mindfulness. And it's a subject which is important in Buddhism. Many books are written about mindfulness. And it's not such a hard thing to understand. Once you understand it, you can start practicing it. And once you start practicing it, it can change your life. It can solve your problems. It can make you a more peaceful, a happy person. It can even overcome the problems in your body and make you healthier. It can empower your meditation and make you enlightened before Christmas. What a wonderful Christmas present that would be. I didn't say which Christmas. And it can just do wonderful things for you. So the topic of the talk tonight is mindfulness. And it's an important part of Buddhism. It's one of the things which are the great treasures of the Dharma. And it's recognized internationally as a powerful force for good in this world. Being mindful, being alert, being awake, and focusing that awareness on important parts of life is a trick to uncovering some of the obstacles and problems we face and overcoming them and transcending them to become a better, happier, more successful person. But what actually is mindfulness? Mindfulness is the awareness, the openness, the ability to see, to not be in a fog and not knowing what goes on. Imagine you were driving your car here this evening to Champaka Buddhist Lodge and that you thought, oh, it's a terrible haze today because of the fires in Indonesia. And you find that no one else saw that haze. It's just because you haven't washed your windscreen for the last 2 or 3 weeks. And it looks like everything is hazy. And when someone points out that your windscreen is dirty because someone writes with their finger, wash me, you can then clean your windscreen, and when your windscreen is clean, you can actually see everything clear and sparkling. You don't have so many accidents then. That's a simile for what mindfulness is. To be able to see very clearly what's going on. And unfortunately, many people are asleep. They live in foggy land because their mind has not had its windscreen washed in many years. So this is not what I said yesterday, Ajahn Brahm's beauty parlor, because I thought about the meaning of beauty in Buddhism. This is also Ajahn Brahm's auto repair workshop. where we clean your windscreen to make you see more clearly and to appreciate more and to be more wise to the problems in life. What sort of problems do we mean? A lot of times the problems in your life become because you're not mindful of how you speak. Too often we speak first and we think later. And that's a big problem. And the first story, I don't think I've ever taught this story in Malaysia. So for those of you who hear my talks every time, that you're going to hear a new story. Isn't that amazing? Many years ago, there was a poor villager in Thailand. And he was a hunter. So he would, you know, persist on his rice fields and he'd go into the jungle to hunt for animals and sometimes find roots and wild fruits to eat and to keep his family alive. And one day while he went deep into the jungle, he found a clearing, and in the middle of the clearing, there was a human skull. At first, he was spooked. He was afraid, as I am afraid sometimes when I see all these empty seats in the front. Are they reserved for the ghosts? Because I don't know why anyone else doesn't sit in those seats in the front. Or perhaps there is someone sitting in there. You people sitting next to an empty seat. Is it really empty? But he saw this skull in the middle of the clearing. And he was an inquisitive fellow, so he went up to that skull and prodded it. Yeah, it was a real human skull. And you can imagine his surprise when the skull talked to him. Hi. What did you say? He said, hi. Don't you understand English? Maybe I should say, selamat pagi. Good morning. Sawadi chow. And it was the first time he'd ever heard a talking skull. And so the man said, what are you doing here? And the skull said, talking brought me here. What do you mean? You'll find out, said the skull, talking brought me here. And the man thought, wow, a talking skull. Wait till I tell my wife about this. She will never believe this. And so, when he went back home, the first thing he said to his wife was, you never guess what I saw. I found a talking skull. No, that's not true. Honest, he said. On my life, I found a human skull which talked. Wow, said his wife. And his wife went next doors and told her best friend. Within that evening, it went all around the village. The next day, it went around town. By the end of the week, it went all around Bangkok. This man had found a talking skull. This was many years ago. And it reached the king. And the king was one of these modern rulers. He did not want to encourage superstition. And he said that that man is lying. You should not believe what people say. Go and arrest him. And so the soldiers arrested that man and brought him to the palace. And the king said, why are you spreading such false rumors? And he said, it's true, sire. I did see that skull, and it talked to me. Listen, said the king. Are you sure? Yes. Be careful, said the king, because I'm going to send you with some soldiers, and you have to find that skull. And if it doesn't talk, they'll execute you there and then. But if it does talk, I'll give you a big reward. The man knew he had heard the talking skull. So he wasn't at all afraid. He thought he was going to become rich. And so he told all his friends, I'm going to become rich. The king is going to reward me for finding the first talking skull. It'll even probably get in the Guinness Book of Records. And so he went with the soldiers. It took him a while, but he found that clearing, and there was a skull right in the middle of the clearing. He thought, I'm going to be a rich man. And so he said, hi, skull. And the skull was silent. Come on, skull, talk, it's your old friend, me. And the skull didn't move. Come on, please, skull, say something. The skull was silent. Please, if you don't talk, they're going to kill me. But the skull refused to say anything. So the soldiers carried out the king's orders. They cut off his head right there. A couple of months later, when the ants and animals had stripped all the flesh off his head, there was another skull in that clearing, two skulls. And that was the time the first skull started speaking again. He said to his new friend, hi. Hi, said his new friend. What brought you here? Said the first skull. Talking brought me here, said the second skull. So be careful of talking. It can kill you. You have to be careful and mindful. How many of you have said the wrong thing to your wife? Once. Man came to visit the monk late in the afternoon. He was very upset, and even though the venerable was busy and had a very tiring day, we monks are very kind. In fact, we're so kind that sometimes people ring me up in Perth from around the world to discuss their problems. We call it dial a monk service. So they ring up dial a monk. Sometimes we do chanting over the phone. But anyhow, this was a man. He didn't do dial a monk. He went to visit the monk. And when he visited the monk, monk said, what did you want? What's the problem? He said, oh, I feel so terrible. I've really scolded my wife. I said terrible things about her. And I feel so bad about what I've said to my wife. I really love her. You know what it's like sometimes? You come home from the office and she does something stupid and you shout at her. And he said, monk, can you help me please? And the monk said, maybe I can help you. Because there is a very rare ceremony which can cure the problem. It's called a chicken ceremony. Have you heard about the chicken ceremony in Malaysia? Only very highly attained monks can perform the chicken ceremony, and it solves all the bad feelings in families. So he said, oh please, Mr. Monk, can you do the chicken ceremony for me? He said, okay, there is just enough time, because first of all I will need a chicken. Obviously. So can you please go to the market? It will still be open. And just buy a chicken, not a live one, a dead one. And on the way back from the market to my temple, I want you to pluck the chicken, take all the feathers out and throw them away. Because when you come here, I want a plucked chicken. So he said, sure, I can do that. So he rushed to the market, he bought a nice chicken. And on the way from the market to the temple, he took all the feathers out and threw them away. And said, here you are, venerable, here's the chicken, now what do I do next? And the monk said, well done. You performed the first part of the chicken ceremony. Now you have to go home and come to me first thing in the morning at dawn, so we can do the second part of the ceremony, which is the powerful part. So he went back home. His wife wasn't speaking to him, but it didn't matter because he knew the problem would be solved tomorrow morning. So he got up early and went to the temple before work, and he met the monk after the morning chanting, and he said, monk, Venerable, can we now do the second part of the ceremony? He said, certainly, said the monk. Now I want you to retrace your steps. Here's the chicken. Go back to the market the way you came last night. Collect all the feathers you threw away and stick them back in the chicken where they came from. And he said, I can't do that. I probably won't be able to find all the feathers. Certainly I can't put them back again. Ah, said the monk. That's the same way. The same when speaking to your wife. Once the words come out of your mouth, you can't collect them and put them back in again. Once they're out forever. And that was the meaning of the chicken ceremony. It taught him to be more mindful of what he says. So he realized that once those words come out, they're out forever, like chicken feathers. You can't put them back where they came from once they've come out. So he learned his lesson there. So he never said a bad word to his wife ever again. And in fact, you understand that when you speak, you should do the triple reflection before you speak, especially to your husband and wife. The triple reflection goes like this. Before you speak, you should think, is this really important? If it's really important, you can tick off the first reflection. Yeah, it's really important. And the second reflection, before you can speak, is it really, really important? And if it's really, really important, you can tick off box number two. And the third reflection, I'm sure you know, you have to think, is it really, really, really important? And only then speak. And that way, most of the time, the person's gone before you can say anything. Which means you don't speak so much. You're more alert and mindful of what you're saying. As somebody once said, if you cannot improve upon the silence, then don't speak. What a beautiful saying that is. If you cannot improve upon the silence, then don't speak. But that takes a lot of awareness and mindfulness. This is an example of what mindfulness means. It is like an overseer. It is like someone who's watching what's going on and can protect you. However, mindfulness is not just looking over what's going on. To be mindful, if you see a problem, you have to do something about it. For example, it's like a person who comes to Chempaka Buddha's lodge in the evening to listen to a great Dhamma talk, but they are a very wealthy person. So they tell the guard on the gate of their house, guard, I want you to be mindful. Be alert, be awake, because there are many burglars around PJ. So be alert, I'm going to the temple, I've got many valuables in my house, be mindful. And the owner of the house comes and listens to a great Dharma talk. They're so happy. And when they go home, they found the burglars have been in their house. So they get very upset at their guard. Look, I pay you to look after my house. I told you to be mindful. And the guard says, madam, I was mindful. I saw the burglars going in. I noted burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I saw the burglars coming out with all your jewelry. I noted jewelry going out, jewelry going out, jewelry going out. The burglars went in again. I noted burglars returning, burglars returning. I saw them taking your big TV set out. I saw big TV going out, big TV going out, big TV going out. Is that mindfulness? Of course it isn't. You'd sack that guard. Being mindful, being alert, also means you react accordingly. So mindfulness is not just being alert, but doing something about it if there is a problem. But of course you can't do anything if you don't see the burglars coming in, if you're fast asleep, or if you're watching the soccer instead of watching the gate. So a burglar has to, sorry, not the burglar, the guard has to be mindful and has to be proactive. Now, here, the guard stands for mindfulness and the house stands for you. You have to look after your body and your mind. When people develop mindfulness, they're more alert. You find some very interesting things happening. First of all, you can be more aware of your body. Why is it that people get so sick these days? Why are there so many cancers and other diseases? You know what happens? Before that cancer really gets to the stage where it's a huge problem, your body is giving you many warnings. Red lights flash again and again and again. The body tells you, please slow down, take a rest, don't be so stressed out. But too often we are not listening. We are not here. We're too busy watching the TV, talking to each other, messing around, so busy we never are mindful enough of our own physical body to actually to listen to the signals. And by the time you go to the doctor, the body says, I've been telling you for years to slow down. Now you've got to really slow down. You're going to the cemetery. Why is it the only people who rest in peace? Where do you see the acronym RIP, rest in peace? I only see it on gravestones. When you're dead. Why do you have to wait till you're dead to rest in peace? Can't you do that now? I want to get one of these t-shirts. You know the t-shirts we have on sale in Buddhist centers? RIP, here and now. When you can enjoy resting in peace. What happens when you develop more awareness, more mindfulness? You can actually feel what's going on in your body. And there are many medical techniques which are available for people now which just tell people to be mindful of this area of the body to create more awareness there. So you can actually feel what you're doing. One of the monks in my monastery has got a very bad back problem. He went to see doctors and physiotherapists and nothing, there was no possible solution for it. It was some congenital trouble with his spine, and it was going to cause him pain for a long time. And as a monk, you're supposed to meditate a lot. And if you've got a bad back, it's very difficult to actually to be a meditating monk. So he was in big trouble. But to his credit, he solved the problem, you know what, with mindfulness of the muscles around his back. Because he read a little book written by a doctor. The book, it taught you that many of the muscles in your body you take for granted, you're not aware of, you don't know what's going on there. And all you needed to do, according to this book, was to start focusing your awareness on these muscles around your back. First of all, touching them, so you get to know where they were. So you build up awareness on that part of your body. After repeated exercise of touching or rubbing, you become aware of that part of the body. When you become aware of that part of the body, you actually are more mindful of what's going on there. And with that awareness, with that observation, you can actually start controlling that area of the body. When you know what's happening there, you can feel it when it's tense, you can feel it when it's relaxed. And you've got that feedback mechanism which allows you to relax those muscles. And that's all he did. He became aware of muscles which most of us don't know exist. He developed that mindfulness. And now because he develops that mindfulness, he can strengthen this muscle, relax that muscle, and now he can sit meditation. It's wonderful just how he solved a problem with his physical health. And it's the same with each one of you. If you have any problem physically in your body, it's amazing if you put attention there, you're mindful of that ache or even of that lump or whatever else is a problem in your body. If you have a brain tumor, do you know what's going on in your brain? Can you be mindful of it? With practice you can. You can actually develop awareness of the inner part of your brain. You have to build that up first of all. And once you've got mindfulness of it, you've got a way of influencing, you know, even tumors. There has been huge amounts of evidence gathered in hospitals in the West which shows that things like mindfulness are a very powerful therapy which actually assists or even is better than some of the medicines which are very expensive and sometimes don't work. It is very much healing your own body by being aware of it. So the mindfulness helps you even be a fit and healthy person. You know another thing which makes you more healthy, I should have mentioned, I'll leave that story for another talk because it fits in later on. But when you're mindful, you're not just mindful of your physical body, you're also mindful of your mental processes. For example, why do you get angry? A lot of times we get angry at our friends and our loved ones and we regret it afterwards. Oh, I blew it. I shot off my mouth. Now my wife's not speaking to me for days and she's not going to cook my dinner either. Ooh. Or my husband. Or the wife shouts off at the husband. You know actually that sometimes in Australia there are some multicultural marriages. There's one family I know, it's an Australian man who's married a Thai girl. The Australian man cannot speak Thai language and the Thai girl can't understand English and they're so happy together. Because they can't get angry at each other, they don't know what they're saying. That's why it's very good to have interracial marriages, especially if you can't understand each other's language. But sometimes we regret our anger, and sometimes people come to me, they have problems with anger, and they get angry at the people they love, they get angry sometimes at their children, and they can even hit them, and that's a big problem. They love their kids, but sometimes that, you know what it's like, you lose it, they say in the West, you lose control, you just get angry and you can get very violent. And so many psychologists who treat such problems, what do they use? Mindfulness training. What mindfulness means is you start to be more aware of the triggers of your anger, and also the whole process after the trigger happens, what causes it, how the process of anger actually happens. You become alert to the mental process which builds up the anger inside of you. If you are not alert to that, it's like not being aware of the part of your body which is getting the cancer. It gives you many signs, and if you don't notice those signs, you're not aware of them, by the time you get the cancer, it's often too late. The same when you get angry. By the time you notice the anger, it's too late and you shout out at someone or you hit someone. So how do you do this? You become aware. Where does the anger come from? What situation were you in? Why did it happen? What was going on in your mind? After a while, you can see the whole process. Once you can see the whole process of where anger comes from, you can stop it very easily. It's like you have a train leaving the station. If you want to stop that train, you've got to put on the brakes pretty quickly when it just leaves the station. Because when it's just starting to move, its momentum is very small. You put the brakes on, it stops immediately. But when that train, the KLIA Express, is going, I don't know how many, 120 kilometers an hour down the track, if you try and put the brakes on, you will not be able to stop. It will take maybe a kilometer or half a kilometer before you can actually stop because the momentum is so strong. If you catch it quickly, it's easy to stop. So what mindfulness does, it enables you to catch things very early. One of our monks, a long time ago, he was an ex-US Marine who was in the army in the Vietnam War. And he suffered an injury to the back of his head from a Viet Cong bullet. He was very lucky to survive the injury, but he did. He was cashiered out of the army with a very good pension, eventually became a monk, but he started to suffer from epileptic fits, simply because of the damage done to that part of his brain. And you know what an epileptic fit is sometimes? A person, you know, goes out of control. It can be very dangerous. They can harm and hurt themselves because their body goes into spasms and they can't do anything about it. He solved the problem by being mindful. He started to notice the whole process before an epileptic fit actually happened. He could see it coming. Because he saw it coming, he could take action to avoid the whole process before it got so bad they would have a fit. And so he never had any fits anymore. Just mindfulness, awareness of the process, what was going on in his mind before the fit actually happened, managed to give him the sense of control so he could actually avoid it. And that mindfulness is very strong with many mental illnesses, not just anger, but some people have had uncontrollable lust, especially men. Sometimes, lust, your mind goes crazy. That's why, you know, they do call such lust crazy, and men actually, they still really love their wives. But they see a nice girl in the office or whatever and they just want to sleep with them and have sex. And they don't realize what they're doing. It's a craziness. And afterwards they regret that so much. It's amazing. Men who commit adultery, they always think they're never going to get caught. They always think that. Moreover, they always try and justify it. Once I was doing a talkback radio show in Perth. Now I like sort of doing weird things, like, you know, talkback radio. That's really good fun because you're sitting there late at night and you're getting all these calls, strange calls, and you have to answer them straight away. Many people are listening to what you say. So, you know, you have to give a good answer. If you mess up, thousands of people hear it. And especially if you really mess up, they record it and play it next week. To make people laugh. Actually, I don't mind messing up. If I make a big mistake and do something stupid, I just regard that as making people happy. If people laugh because I'm being stupid, what a wonderful thing that is. I'm giving joy to the world. For example, I don't mind sort of making mistakes, but one of the stories I remember, being a young monk in Thailand. Now with a great master, Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah enjoyed having Western monks around because they were always a source of so much fun and amusement. And one example which comes to mind, because the monastery was very poor in those days, And there's only a few monks there when I went there. Whenever you needed any requisite, in this particular case, soap, what you would do, the Ajahn Chah would have a big water jar next to his seat. When people gave requisites, he just put them all in there. And it was for everybody. We shared everything. And actually, sometimes we ran out of soap. I remember one time we ran out of soap for 3 or 4 days. And when the villagers smelt us, they offered all this amazing amount of soap for us. But we didn't have any choice. So that particular time I needed some soap. So you go to see Ajahn Chah and just ask for soap. And he just put his hand in a big jar and whatever soap came out, he'd give it to you. So I needed some soap, so I went to his hut to ask for soap. But of course I had to ask for it in Thai. The Thai word for soap is sabu. But I said sapo instead of sabu. So he said, what did you ask for? I said, sapo. Now, sapo means pineapple. So what Ajahn Chah was asking, what do you want a pineapple for? And I said, to wash. And he almost fell off his chair when he told all the other monks, oh, it's amazing the culture in the West. In England, people wash with pineapples. And never let me forget that. I was the monk who washed with a pineapple. So I caused him much amusement. He had a lot of funny times with us. Another time, I got the word for bean mixed up. Because I said I like beans. I like to eat beans. And the word I used for bean, actually the word for bean is tua. And the word I use is tue. And the monk said, what, you like to eat plates? Because that's what a tue means, a plate or a dish. And I said, oh yeah, they're very delicious. And he was laughing all day on that. Ajahn Brahm likes to eat plates. But whenever I made a mistake and made a fool of myself, I thought, what a wonderful thing that is, because it makes people happy. And makes people laugh. So I don't mind making mistakes, because it brings joy to everybody. So if you make a mistake and say an idiotic thing, what a great gift of compassion that was for the world. You made another person laugh. Anyhow, back to the mindfulness, of the mental processes. Whether it's anger or in this particular case, lust, sometimes that we need to be more alert. We can see the whole process coming. Whether you're a monk or whether you're married, we all have to restrain ourselves. Because as girls you can see this really hot guy you really like, but you're married or you've got a partner already. You've got to restrain yourself, and you guys have to restrain yourself as well. And mindfulness is what really helps. You're alert and aware of what's going on. When I started getting aware and mindful of what's going on, I realized where lust comes from. When you want a romantic evening, where do you go? You go to the nightclub. Or you go to a candlelit restaurant. Or you go for a walk under the moonlight. Aren't they romantic places? And you know why they're romantic? Because they're all dark, so you can't see what you're falling in love with. No one ever gets romantic in the middle of the day under the sunshine. The point is that when we want to have lust, we actually don't want to be mindful. We won't want to be aware. We want to get off on the rush of pleasure. So be careful. If you're mindful, at least you're alert and you know what you're doing. When you know what you're doing, you're more in control and you can take remedial action if you really need to. So same with people who have other addictions such as smoking or gambling or even drug addiction. Unfortunately, those things happen in our modern world. So what do Buddhists do about such drug addiction? If you have a kid who's addicted to, say, pornography on the internet, how can you help that child? Or if you are smoking, you know it's bad for you, but you just can't stop yourself. You use mindfulness. The mindfulness, just like the person who, I said, the monk who had an attack of epilepsy, he could see where that was coming from. Before he turned on the computer and accessed those sites, you can see why you want to do that. The whole process. And when you're alert and mindful, it's like having a guard on the house. You can see the burglar of addiction coming in to steal your happiness and your sense of self-worth. If you see them coming, you can stop them early. The best time to stop a burglar is when they're still outside your house. So you stop that whole process before it really catches you. Because you know, once you get in there, you just can't turn it off. Once you've got that cigarette in your hand, you have to put it in your mouth. But you can see the whole process coming on. And seeing that whole process is what gives you the possibility of control. That's why mindfulness training solves so many problems in our daily life, in our world. And why mindfulness training is used in many therapies in our modern world. But it's more than just solving the problems in your worldly life. Mindfulness also enhances your life. When we train mindfulness in meditation, our mindfulness gets stronger. We actually lighten up our mind, like turning the lights on in this room. If we turn the lights up, we can see much more. Sometimes, as a man, I often have to shave, and when I look in my mirror, I don't like to have a strong light on my chin, because if I have the strong light, that's when I can see all my stubble. The lighter it is, the more you can see. It's the same, any pretty girl, if you put the spotlight on her, then you can see all her pimples and defects. We all have pimples and defects, that's life. But we like to have darkness so we can't see them. Mindfulness is like turning up the lights of your mind. And that's what we're doing in our meditation retreat, increasing our mindfulness. And I'll tell you some of the benefits of this. One of the first meditation retreats I went on, I was still a student. And I got into meditation while I was still at college. It was a wonderful thing to do. Not only did it mean I passed my exams with flying colors, but it also meant I was a very well-adjusted young man, and I enjoyed my life much more than other students did. But on this occasion, the group of students who were in the Buddhist club at Cambridge, this was in 1969 or 70, we hired a couple of boarding houses during the vacation period. The students were away, we hired them, and we held a meditation retreat there. When I signed up for the retreat, I wanted to meditate, but I thought, oh my goodness, the food is going to be terrible. For those of you who know the English culture, the English are not known for their food. The French are known for food, the English are known for other things. In those days, the food would always be a three-course meal. Stodge, stodge, and stodge. No flavor in it. Any vegetables would be boiled, so there was no taste left. That's why you have to put gravy on, or salt and pepper, to give it some sort of flavor. And of all the places to eat in England, the worst cooks of all would get work in the boarding houses for poor students. Everybody complained about the food you get in these places. So when I realized we're going to stay in a boarding house, I realized the food is going to be really awful. But who cares? I just want to meditate. But to my surprise, the food actually started tasting delicious. The longer the retreat went on, the more tasty was the food. At the time, I thought I must have struck lucky. I must have good karma and got the one cook in the whole of the country who could make something taste reasonable. But now I realize it was nothing to do with the cook. When you are mindful, you can actually pick up more of the taste. Your mind is becoming more sensitive. So the tiny bit of flavor which was left after she boiled everything out of it, I could pick up. Now I realize this, and those yogis on this retreat will probably confirm this. When you start meditating and mindfulness starts to get stronger, the food tastes more delicious. Because you're more mindful, you're more sensitive to the taste. The moral of that story is, if you're going out to an expensive restaurant, you must meditate for half an hour beforehand to build up your mindfulness so you can get your money's worth. Because it's true, when you're sensitive, when you're mindful, you can pick up more. And this is one of the wonderful things about meditation. Not only does your food taste more delicious, but your wife looks more beautiful, especially when she's old. The little bit of beauty which is left in her, you can pick up and be sensitive to. And your husband is also just more hunky. In other words, you appreciate each other more because you're more aware. Not only that, you can appreciate life more. Little things which you pass by and you don't really notice, they become more beautiful. Mindful people see more beauty in the world. Now I understand where depression comes from. The major cause of depression in our modern world, for me, is a gross lack of mindfulness. We get so dull, so tired, so negative, that our mind starts to shut down. And we see everything through a fog. The colors are drained of brightness. I know this because many years ago I visited my family in London about this time of the year, of November, December. That's the worst time to go to that part of the world. And my brother was telling me that there was a condition known, I think it's called seasonal depression or something. Because at that time of the year, the sun comes up maybe about 10 o'clock in the morning, and sunset is about 2 or 3 in the afternoon. So it's not bright. The whole light is so dull, and it's dark most of the day because it's on the high latitudes. And because that things are dull and dark, and you know what happens in London? Those of you who've been there, all the buildings, no one paints the buildings bright colours. At least in Malaysia, you've got the beautiful red roofs of the temples, you go to the Hindu temples and they're really interesting with brightly coloured. In England, everything is grey. Look at the buildings, they're grey. And the sky, it's always grey. You never see the sun. It's all clouds. and even the pavements, the roads, is all grey. At that time of the year, there is no green on the trees. How do people dress? Have you seen people dressing in England? They've got these grey overcoats, these grey hats, and these grey scarves. At that time of the year, you don't see any colour. All you see is grey. And you know what tea English people like? Earl Grey tea. Everything is grey. No wonder they get depressed and miserable. And you know that this psychologist was curing hundreds of people simply by taking them into a room which was brightly lit, putting Hawaiian shirts with all these flowers and motifs on the people, and playing nice, loud, lively music. And that got rid of their depression. It actually took them out of their grey world into brightness. That's what mindfulness does. Depressed people actually see the world like in the Northern Hemisphere winter. Everything actually looks grey. Whenever they taste their delicious food, it's got no taste left. It's just ordinary, it's bland. They listen to their favourite music, it's just sound. They see their loved friends, it's just them again. Nothing actually bites them, nothing actually excites them. They're dull. That means the mind is very tired and grey. Once you get into that state, it's very, very hard to get out of. But sometimes all you need is to develop a mindfulness. When the mindfulness gets strong, you turn up the lights in your mind, and even the grey clouds look interesting. Just like the grey food I got in that retreat was delicious, simple things become full of life and colours become brighter. You see deeper into things and it's more beautiful. So mindfulness actually makes you happier. You get more out of life. You're right there when things are happening. You're in life rather than dulled out. That's why monks are happy. I enjoy my life. Sometimes people think Ajahn Brahm's over the top with all his jokes and laughing around. But no, that's actually, the suttas say that's what monks were like in the time of the Buddha. Why have I got so much energy and enjoy my life no matter what happens? It's because you've got strong mindfulness. The tea tastes more delicious when you're mindful. Everything starts to glisten and glow, and you see beauty in the most unexpected places. That's actually a sign mindfulness is growing. And as your mindfulness grows more and more, you start to see more, which is where insight comes from. To gain insight, you have to be very aware, very mindful. And the classic story, which I use to show what I mean, is the story of my monastery in Perth. Bodhinyana Monastery, named after Ajahn Chah's formal ecclesiastical name, was built on top of a mountain, on top of a hill. The reason why we insisted on building monasteries on top of hills is because it's our tradition that holy people always live on top of mountains. You never hear of holy people living in swamps. However, there is one holy person, a wise person, who does live in a swamp. Apparently that's Yoda from Star Wars. I find that out from one of my young monks. But that's not real, that's only Hollywood. But real wise people don't live in swamps like Yoda. He was a Jedi Knight apparently, whatever that means. But real holy people live on top. So we built our monastery on top of a mountain. For 9 years, I'd always go up to my monastery in a car. That's one of the trouble with being a monk these days. No one will let you walk anywhere. Even when I first came in here, you insisted I go up in the lift. Now I've put my foot down, I insist I walk up the stairs and walk down again. Why do you think I'm so fat? Because you don't allow me to exercise. I try and walk to somewhere and say, no, no, Ajahn Brahm will give you a lift. You're trying to kill me. And what happens at dana time? You say, oh, eat this, it's delicious. It doesn't matter anyway. But this day was a beautiful morning. I had lots of time after 9 years of going up and down that hill in a vehicle. For the first time, I decided to walk up that hill. And walking up that hill changed a lot of the way I looked at life. I got a great insight from this experience. Because when I started walking up that hill, the hill looked very different than anything I'd ever seen before. I couldn't recognize my surroundings. If you want to find this out, if in your house you've always gone in and out of that house in your car, maybe tomorrow or some other day soon, just get out the car maybe 100 meters from your gate and walk. You'll see things you've never noticed before. That's what happened to me. Walking up that hill, I could not recognize that hillside. It's about 2 kilometers, that's all. What I saw was so different than I remembered when I looked out of a window of a car. I just stopped. And when I stopped and looked again, I saw even more things I hadn't noticed when walking. I saw more detail, and what I saw became more beautiful. The colors started to become deeper. And having been a scientist before, I started to contemplate what is going on. And it's quite clear to me, when you know the biology of your eye, when I was going through or looking through the window of a speeding car, the light hitting my retina never had full time to make a proper image before more light came in, dislodging the old, and another image replaced the first, and another image replaced that in quick succession, because I was looking through the window of a speeding car. And my mind didn't have a chance to explore those images on the back of my retina. So what I saw was just fast snapshots of the scenery outside. When I started walking, I was going slower. So the light had more time to form an image on my retina. So I saw more, and what I saw had more detail, and the colors were richer, they weren't so washed out. And when I stopped, that was a time I had full opportunity to have a true image form on the back of my retina, the back of my eye on the retina, and my mind had all the time in the world to explore it. That's why not only did I see more detail, but what I saw became more beautiful. The colors were richer and deeper, the detail was exquisite. And that's the simile I use for the development of mindfulness. The slower you go, the more mindful you are. The more mindful you are, the more you see, and the more beauty you experience in life. Colors become richer, detail becomes exquisite, you literally feel and appreciate more. Now you know why people get depressed. You're going so fast that life doesn't really manifest itself in its beauty to you. Colors are washed out, flavors are dull and bland. Even your friends don't really interest you anymore. Simply because you're moving too fast. You're living life like looking through the window of a speeding car. When you slow down and mindfulness increases, you see more, what you see is more interesting. And if you can even stop in meditation, you bliss out. You find this ordinary thing called life is very beautiful. And you look at your friends and loved ones and you see so much incredible beauty in them. You see their Buddha nature, and the Buddha is beautiful. They always had that, but you never saw it because you were going too fast. And you also see your own beauty. That's how you can love yourself and be at peace with yourself. The slower you go, the more beautiful you become. You see more, and that's what you see. That's why mindfulness leads to wisdom. Wisdom leads to happiness, the happiness of enlightenment. So I started this talk this evening by just talking about ordinary mindfulness and how you can use it to have a healthier body by picking up the signs of incipient sickness. You can also use it to control things like addictions and things which cause trouble in your life, like bad speech, or by like addictions to smoking or gambling or whatever. You're more in control. You can stop it before it gets hold of you. And you can also use it to develop a more awareness and cut off the depressions of life, see life more deeply, and live life more fully. Here a monk is saying this to you. Live life more deeply, more fully, with more passion. Compassion, that is. All coming from a monk. I enjoy my life. I live it fully, appreciating it deeply, simply because I've cultivated my mindfulness. Please join me in seeing the beauty of all living beings and the beauty of life. When you stop, life becomes enjoyable. That's the talk tonight. Any questions? Okay, any questions or comments? I hope you've been listening. Sometimes in Perth, the following day after people I give a talk, I ask people about what I talked about, and the only thing they usually remember are the jokes. Okay. And you want to use this one? Here we go. Oh, that one up there. Very good. Anyone who has a question, tonight we have special prize for the best question, a free haircut from Ajahn Brahm. You know, there is like a hairdresser in Perth called Nirvana Hair Salon. I think that's where I should get my hair cut.
Anyone who has questions can write on the pieces of paper that are being passed around.
Yeah.
Before the questions come in, a little commercial here.
Okay, here we go. Pay attention, a note from our sponsors.
As you walk out, you can see some donation boxes outside. One towards Ajahn Brahm's Meditation Center in Perth, and one towards future Dharma propagation activities. Your donation, big or small, certainly will go a long way. Thank you.
And we also accept IOUs, if you haven't got any money with you. Okay, who's got the first question? Actually, just while the questions are coming in, on donations, recent research which is done in the United States on wealth and happiness, they wanted to find out, is it really true, the more money you earn, the happier you are? And what the research actually found out, your income actually reaches a peak, you know, where your happiness is the most. And more income, actually you get less happiness. You get more worries, the more rich you are. And they actually found the optimum income in the United States for happiness was $50,000 a year. More than that, you earn more money, your happiness level goes down. It's proved. So, if there's anyone here who's earning more than $50,000 US a year, Chempaka Buddhist Lodge can make you much happier. I think you know how. Okay, we've got some first questions here. Here comes question. A question there. Are you going to ask one? This is best. A question being asked. Wonderful. Can you take the microphone?
Ajahn Brahm, can I ask a simple question?
Certainly.
I think you recognize me.
Yes, certainly.
Is awareness more difficult than mindfulness? Because I heard that awareness is deeply important. Than mindfulness.
Oh, the awareness is more deeply rooted than mindfulness.
Yeah.
Personally, I use the words interchangeably. When you're mindful, you're very aware. When you're aware, you're mindful. But I think maybe what you might mean is that the mindfulness is more focused on certain things. Awareness is just general. But mindfulness is when you use that awareness, that wakefulness, and you put it on areas which really affect your happiness and other people's happiness. Is that what you mean?
maybe in my mind, awareness is more deeper.
More deeper?
Yes, because mindfulness, you can remind yourself anytime.
Okay. I think what you're saying is the way that many people use the word mindfulness, you're either mindful or you're not mindful. But the way I understand that word, that mindfulness has many, many different levels. You have ordinary mindfulness, and I actually coined the words power mindfulness and superpower mindfulness. By that I mean that when you really get still, your mindfulness increases by leaps and bounds. And sometimes your mindfulness gets so strong, you can read other people's minds. But I'm not going to do that to you, I promise.
Ajahn Brahm, is it possible when you are meditating, you notice your mindfulness is there, is around, but when you are not around, say in your daily life, your mindfulness may lose.
Okay, in your daily life, sometimes your mindfulness does get decreased. Yes. But this is why we actually meditate, to actually recharge our energies. What's happening, it's like in your car, sometimes you run out of gas. So when you run out of gas, you have to go to the petrol station and get a refill. It's the same when you run out of mindfulness, sit down and meditate some more and fill up again. And that way your mindfulness gets recharged. It's true what you say, because if you lose your mindfulness in daily life,
yes,
sometimes you make terrible mistakes which you regret.
When the atmosphere around you is so attractive, you lose your mindfulness totally sometimes after your meditation.
Sometimes people do that, they lose their mindfulness. Like on a recent retreat which I gave last month, I told everybody, look, after you leave a retreat, you've been watching your breath going up, but now you have to drive the car home. And I told people, drive up and down the side streets first of all, because you have to get your mindfulness on driving and away from your breath. And one disciple had a car crash. Because she was watching her breath instead of watching the traffic.
So, Ajahn, may I say, I'm not the stupid fellow of asking a question right in front of you. Ajahn, you always say that those who do not ask the questions, you become more stupid.
Yeah. So, you're investing in your rebirth. You will be professor in your next month.
I always remember Ajahn's word. Those who ask the first question will not be the stupid fellow.
Very good. Congratulations. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Thank you. And it's also very kind, because when the first person has the courage to ask a question, other people also get encouraged as well to ask questions. So well done. Oh, we've got all sorts of questions here. What is the spirit of renunciation? I don't drink spirits. The spirit of renunciation is simplicity and freedom. So we renounce to make life more simple and be more free. The smaller your house, the less it costs to employ a maid. Or if you've got such a small house, the less time your wife or you have to work cleaning it up. So renunciation is simplicity. And the less you have in life, the quicker you can retire. Sometimes the people, they save and save and save because they're working for their retirement. But if you learn to live simply now, you can retire early. Just like me. I retired when I was 23. That makes a lot of sense. Question 2. If a female can equally attain arahatship, why did Lord Buddha refuse requests for female ordination to become bhikkhunis for 3 times? You have to ask the Buddha that. But although he did refuse for the 3 times, the 4th time he said yes, and that's the most important. It's just like that sometimes that there was this Indonesian lady, she asked me to go to Indonesia. I refused many times, but in the end I said yes. So now I'm going. The last thing is the most important. So the Buddha actually said, yes, they can become ordained. So they did become ordained. And so we have the nun Sangha. So women can become fully enlightened. Which is why, instead of arguing about this and having conferences, there are women allowed to become monks or not allowed to become monks? Can they become enlightened or not enlightened? I got a bit fed up with people talking about it, so we did something. We started a nun's monastery, a forest monastery in Perth, and it's thriving. Actions speak louder than words, so just stop arguing, just go and do it. Now why did Lord Buddha mention that Bhikkhuni's establishment will shorten the Buddha Sasana for 500 years? It didn't shorten the Buddha. It's still going. The Buddha also said, as long as there are people practicing the Eightfold Path, you'll always find stream winners, once returners, non-returners, and our arahats. So we shouldn't just focus on one thing the Buddha said, we should actually see the other things which the Buddha said. And when you see it in context, the Buddha said, no, as long as there are people practicing, let's have enlightened beings in this world. And as you know, there are enlightened beings now, and it's 2,500 years since the Buddha's, over 2,500 years since the Buddha passed away, so the Sasana did not, the Buddhism did not die out after 500 years. It's still going strong, it's growing. When I give a talk in Perth, my president, who's the IT guy, it's all on the internet, I give a talk usually in Perth to 300 people live every Friday evening when I'm in town. But 17,000 listen to it on the internet. Every talk which I give. And he said, as an example, there's one group who meet every week in Iceland to listen to the Dhamma, one of my talks over the internet. So that tells me that Buddhism is growing. It hasn't died out at all. It's going to places where Buddhism has never gone. As I said this afternoon in another talk, I said, because I used to like Star Trek before I became a monk, our mission is to go where no one has ever gone before. Star. Quite right. What was it? Anybody know what the right words were? Something like that. To go where no man has ever been before, or something. Anyway. Wow, a lot of questions here. Quickly. There is There is number 8 or 10 precepts, Mechi in Thailand, Donchi in Cambodia, Salisi in Myanmar, as ordained person in Sutta. It was established much later. Is it proper according to Dhamma Vinaya? Yeah. It's okay to, everybody is allowed to keep precepts. I can't tell people not to take precepts. And in fact, if I tried to hinder somebody taking the precepts, that would be very, very bad karma for me. Because I'm stopping people doing good. And the Buddha says specifically that if you stop people doing a good act, that's very bad karma. If you as a parent stop your child becoming a monk or a nun, that's bad karma. You're stopping a person wanting to do something good with their life and good for other people. Imagine if my father already died, if he stopped me becoming a monk, and I wouldn't be here. That'd be bad karma if my parents had stopped me. But fortunately, my mother gave me that freedom, said, yes, go and do it. So we should encourage people to take precepts. 5 precepts, 8 precepts, 10 precepts. Encourage people to be generous. Encourage people to be virtuous. Encourage people to go to temples. We're encouraging goodness in the world. So certainly, encouraging people to become nuns and monks is wonderful. And if it is improper, would nuns fall to hell? No, they don't fall to hell. They go to heaven or nirvana. They're really good, kind people. Only bad people, fish people, go to hell. Actually, we're not selfish. The angry people go to hell. So if anyone gets angry about nuns, they're the ones who go to hell. Since it was not established by the Lord Buddha, how could it be proper? The Buddha established the precepts. He established 10 precepts, 8 precepts, 5 precepts. That was established in the time of the Buddha. The Buddha said he established the 4 assemblies. The monk assembly, the lay men in white assembly. In other words, you guys. He established the nuns in brown, which includes the 10 preceptors. That's where they belong in that group. And the lay women in white, which is you girls who come here. Know the upasikas. That was established by the Buddha, and the Buddha said until he established that and made it strong, he wouldn't leave the world into parinibbana. Established by the Buddha, it's very good to do. Keep on going. Can the 8 or 10 precepts learn the bhikkhuni vinaya and practice some of it in daily life, e.g. work down brown, dark brown colour robe, bind the bat, ask confession, etc.? Yes, that's what our nuns do in Perth. Ajahn Sumedho's nuns do very similar. If anyone goes to visit Perth, don't just come and see my monk's monastery, go and see Dharmasala nun's monastery as well. If you can't afford to go to Perth, check out the website, bsw.org. You can go for a journey through our nun's monastery, see the pictures on the website. And you see that there we're doing it. And I was the main instigator of that, and I'm not going to hell. So I support that. Go and see it for yourself. It's a wonderful to see. How many, do you have enough teachers here in Malaysia to spread the Dhamma? Are all you always trying to find good teachers to lead retreats and give Dhamma talks? Why is it that we can somehow stop 50% of the population, women? Can't we encourage them? And if we encourage them, some of those will become great teachers. And they will be able to serve the Buddhist groups and temples in Malaysia. Quite frankly, I don't care what gender a person is. I don't even care whether they're Theravada, Mahayana, Zen or Vajrayana. If they give a good talk, I want to listen. It's their goodness, their inspiration, their wisdom. That's what I respect. And I don't care whether it's a man or a woman. Even if a gay person becomes a monk and gives a good talk, I will listen. Obviously you would. It's the Dharma which is important, not the person. So, how we do it? So we'll search 8 or 10 precept nuns who imitate Sangha fall into hell. Now they go to enlightenment or heaven. Where can we look for the history of how Bhikkhuni Sangha was established, how Theravada Bhikkhuni Sangha died off and spread to China? There's lots of that. Google in Bhikkhuni on the web. What a wonderful thing it is, the internet. You can find out everything you want in there. Find out. There's lots of discussion, and usually at the present time the movement is to reintroduce the nuns and to support them in all parts of Buddhism. It's a force which cannot be stopped now. It's happening. And you'll see many nuns in Malaysia in the next 10-20 years. So maybe I'll leave that. There's the same questions, and I've got many other questions to come. So the Bhikkhuni is a good thing to have. And they're all capable of being arahats, fully enlightened. We need them. So please, more ladies, renounce the world, become Bhikkhunis. You know, actually, if you really want to be inspired, read the accounts of the nuns in the book called the Therigatha. Wonderful teaching, all about the enlightened nuns and their stories. And many of those nuns, when they wrote their poems, they said that once we became a nun, that we gave up the three crooked things. You know what the three crooked things are in Buddhism, which a woman gives up to join the monastic order? The first crooked thing is the ladle, which they make the curries with. That's a symbol for cooking. Because when you don't have to cook again. How much time do you spend on the stoves in the kitchen? That's the first crooked thing you give up when you join the monastery. The second crooked thing you give up is the broom, which you sweep the house with. In other words, when you become a nun, you give up housework. What a wonderful thing that is, for you don't have to clean the place anymore, you don't have to cook. And the third crooked thing you give up is the husband. That's what it says in these books 2500 years old. Those are the three crooked things a woman gives up when you join the monastic order. And once they give them up, they don't want to go back to the three crooked things ever again. So even in those days, had a great sense of humour. Okay, how should one balance mindfulness with concentration? Could concentration overpower mindfulness, or vice versa? Please explain. No, mindfulness empowers concentration, and concentration empowers mindfulness. You know what I said yesterday? Instead of saying concentration, say stillness. When the mind becomes still, the mindfulness gets incredibly powerful. Remember the story I said, walking up the hill, when you go slow and still, that's what concentration is, stillness, focused on one thing, not moving. And that's when mindfulness really starts to get powerful. That's why I get off on meditation. When my mind becomes still, the mindfulness gets incredibly powerful. Whatever you see and feel, you feel so deeply, so fully, so powerfully, so happily. The insight which I discovered is that the energy of mindfulness, its power, is called bliss. And that bliss is an important part of the path to enlightenment. Without that bliss and that huge amount of energy, you can't see deeply into things. That's why this path you're going on, not only do you get really awake and alert, you get blissed out. And that bliss is good. It leads to enlightenment. The Buddha said again and again, do not be afraid of that bliss. Develop it, cultivate it, make much of it. Because anyone who gets attached to the mind can only expect one of four things. This is Pasadaka Sutta Digha Nikaya. If you get attached to the bliss of the mind, all you can expect is stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment. That's the word of the Buddha. In other words, if you get off on the bliss of the mind, you're on the way to enlightenment. Another quote which I love is the Buddha said that this Eightfold Path is a path without groaning. There's no groans on this path. There's smiles and happiness. So if any of you yogis on this retreat are groaning, you've lost the way. If you're smiling and happy, you're on the path to enlightenment. A path without groaning is a path of Buddhism. What a beautiful saying that is of the Lord Buddha himself. Mindfulness empowers concentration or stillness, and stillness empowers mindfulness, and the two grow and grow until they reach their peak. Perfect, powerful mindfulness. Bliss and stillness all together. And then you're on the edge of enlightenment. Dear sir, the question is not on mindfulness, but I always wondered whether intelligence can exist outside of a corporal body, such as existence of phantom spirits and apparitions, and also rebirth. When you get really mindful, when you get powerful mindfulness, maybe you can see things. Why is it that meditators, when they really get a strong mind, can start to see devas and ghosts and other things? Because it has power. Remember what I said about most people being in a fog? You can't see things which are there, because you're too dull. When the mind gets empowered, you start to see more and more and more. That's where you get psychic powers from a strong mind. So that's what happens, it's nature. And it is true that there are such beings as ghosts and heavenly beings, but you don't need to be afraid. Because those ghosts, as someone said earlier, they're quite cute. They're real softies, really. All they want is a little bit of merit, that's all. Sure, they're sometimes playful, but like a little playful puppy or a playful child, you can discipline them. Stop messing around, ghost. And they'll do what you tell them. So you can tell off your ghost if it's messing around. If they won't listen to you, you say, I'm going to call Ajahn Brahm if you don't behave. And the ghost will behave. Such things actually exist. And rebirth also exists. I think there's one of the talks is going to be on reincarnation. So come to that talk. And you hear all about where you came from and where you're going and how you can find out. Reincarnation is coming soon. And those of you who died before that talk happens, you'll find out for yourself anyway. Next question. People who suffer from mental sickness and do not know, are not aware, what are they are doing? Are they subject to the law of karma? Now, whatever they do in a state of like madness or unconsciousness, that's not karmically effective. So karma is intention. You have to mean it before it karmically happens. Venerable sir, I heard some amazing psychic feats done by Ajahn Chah. Was Ajahn Chah an arahat? I say yes, because I knew him. Can you believe what I say? How can you? You don't know, I might be wrong. So you don't know unless you actually have lived with that person and check them out. Well, I say he was, because I lived with him for 9 years, and he's an amazing fellow. How can one practice mindfulness in a busy world, competing with one another for worldly success? Mindfulness gives you the competitive edge. It does. When you're mindful, you're really alert. you can pick up things which your competitors don't. For example, when you're with a client, or you're about to cut a deal with somebody, you have to really be alert, because your person you're doing a deal with, they're going to try and get as much as they can for paying the least amount of money. That's business. Don't you have to be really sharp, alert, aware, and mindful? And if you really are mindful, you can actually pick up things. You pick up their body language, the way they speak, the way they look. Mindful people see much more. When you see much more, you can spot scams coming a long way off. When you can do that, obviously you don't lose so much money and you make much more. Also, mindful people can see business opportunities. If those of you who want a good business opportunity in KL, meditation is becoming very popular throughout the world. Why not open up a meditation shop? Selling meditation cushions, tapes, and meditation wear. Already people do that for yoga. There are yoga shops where you can buy your favorite yoga cushion or candles with aromatherapy to enhance your peace. There's heaps of opportunities in the world for these sorts of practices. If you're really mindful and alert, people spot these things and they make fortunes. So mindfulness gives you the competitive edge. So, those of you, I think I've already told you that in April I'm going to London. In April I'm going to London to give a masterclass. That's one of the big sessions of the 2007 Human Resources and Development Conference. They're flying me all the way from Australia to London to teach business leaders how to run their companies. And I'm a Buddhist monk. I've left the world. And they recognize that such things like mindfulness, compassion, and the wisdom of a Buddhist monk will increase the bottom line of a company. And they get 2,000 people from across Europe, CEOs, vice presidents, are coming to listen to a Buddhist monk teach them how to make better business. Isn't that wonderful? I really like that. Could practice of mindfulness and meditation help alleviate dementia or memory loss when we get old? Yes, of course it does. I've never seen a demented monk. Even I've seen some monks over 100 years old. Why? Because if you don't use it, you lose it. And mindfulness keeps your mind alert. It gives it energy. And so it does not go into the dullness of dementia. The Buddha actually said this. People who cultivate mindfulness have great memories. They remember things said and done long ago. That's actually one of the reasons why I did well at my exams, because my memory was very good. I had a natural mindfulness, obviously from previous lives. That's why I could remember answers and examinations, and I remember when my teacher told me that. It wasn't a photographic memory, but it was pretty close. That's because you were mindful. And I teach kids to be mindful. When you are at a lecture or at a class, make your mind as empty as possible, as still as possible, listen with everything you've got. Don't try to remember. Make your mind still, and all that information will go in, and you can remember it very easily. Learning how to listen. And kids who do that, they can remember so well. It makes schoolwork so much easier. And also, you don't get dementia. When the Buddha passed away, does he exist in a pure energy form, or does Nirvana mean he doesn't exist anywhere? He never existed in the first place. It was just five khandhas. There was no self there to begin with. It's just a play of conditions. And that's how the Buddha answered the question. What is the Buddha anyway? Who are you? Do you exist? Or are you just a play of forces with no essence? The Buddha's teaching about emptiness and non-self says if you look deeply enough, there's nothing there. What are you sitting on now? A chair. Is it solid? You ask any physicist and say that chair is made up of atoms. And if you look at the atoms as just being like a little ball, the distance to the next atom is so far away that your chair is 99.9999, many nines, nothingness, emptiness. If you look at that atom, it's made of an electron field surrounding a tiny nucleus. One atom is 99.9999999, many nines, emptiness, space. You look at the solid part, the nucleus is made out of protons and neutrons. If you look at a proton, it's just made up of these little particles called quarks. And even a proton is 99.9999999% nothing. And even what's left there, a quark, it's not really solid, it's not a thing. It's always moving, it's an energy probability field, that's all. So when scientists actually look at what matter is, it looks so solid, but there's nothing there. Just like you. You think you are so solid. Me. If you look more closely, you find there's nothing there. Oh, what a relief. When there's nothing there, there's nothing to worry about anymore. Because there's no one to do the worrying. Oh, what a relief. I don't have to be so concerned anymore. So, backtrack. Please explain a simple meditation technique. Okay, simple meditation, a mantra. You know the many of the mantras we use, like Om Mani Padme Hum, Buddho, Buddho. I'll teach you a very simple mantra. As you breathe in, you recite shut. As you breathe out, up. Shut, up, shut, up, shut, up. That's a very simple meditation technique and it shuts you up. If we need to teach young children meditation, how do we go about it? Are there any resources that we can refer to? There's many books about teaching meditation to children. And I talked a bit about that yesterday, so I won't go into that too much. Get a book like Teaching Meditation to Children, or get on the internet, put meditation children together and see what's available. There's heaps there. Venerable Sir, can you please give some instruction on breathing meditation or any meditation that helps improve mindfulness? You should have joined the retreat, because I've been doing that all day. Or, if you haven't got the retreat, my latest book, I should have brought a whole heap from Singapore here, it's called Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, published in the United States by Wisdom, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. The Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore has heaps of copies. You can get it from them, or you can get it from Amazon. So, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond by Ajahn Brahm. I think it was $25 in Australia. I forget how much it is in Singapore. But if you don't get enlightened after reading that book, you can ask for your money back. I didn't say you get your money back, but you can always ask. And there is heaps, every instruction which I've ever given just about is there in that book. How could a person marry a guy who is ugly and terrible but rich? She prefers to suffer in comfort than to suffer in poverty. You don't marry a guy because he's rich in money, you marry a guy who's rich in his kindness. And then you'll be comfortable. It doesn't matter what guy looks like. I just before I came here on Friday evening, I was stayed in Singapore because they wanted me to teach a youth camp. So there was Singaporean Buddhists from the age of 16 to 21. And I wanted to teach them some Buddhism, some Dhamma. So one of the things I did, I asked the girls, what do you want in a guy, in a boyfriend? And I asked the boys, what do you want in a girlfriend? Because when you are 16, you don't know what, you know, the other sex wants from you. And it was great, so the girls could say what they liked in a boy. He didn't have to be some tough guy who wore all the latest designer clothing, you know, with studs in his ears and rings in his nose. That's not what impressed the girls. And it's great that boys understand this, so they don't start doing stupid things like racing cars and motorbikes. That doesn't impress a girl at all. Well, the girls said they liked boys who were compassionate, had a sense of humor, who were fun to be with. It was great understanding that. So at last the boys know what girls want, and the girls understand what the boys want. I wish I'd have been told that when I was young. I might not have made it to be a monk. But do you really want just to live in material comfort but no spiritual or emotional comfort? And of course you'd hate that. Your mansion will become a prison for you. So a person, doesn't matter if they're ugly or if they're poor, as long as they're kind, compassionate and good fun, then you'll have a happy life together, whether you're a boy or girl. That's my answer. So a person will marry a guy who's ugly and terrible but rich because they're stupid. In the Eightfold Path, can Ajahn kindly elaborate on the Buddha's teaching on right mindfulness? Right mindfulness is empowered by having no hindrances, and it focuses on the parts of life where you think you exist. The four satipatthanas are all supposed to uncover non-self, that you're not the body. Now you all know that, but you forget it sometimes. And you're not your feelings of pleasure and pain. They just pass through you and you can't control them. You are not your mind or knower. The mind doesn't, just comes and goes as well. And you're not the other things which arise in the mind, like the will. It's just finding out you're not these things. So you become mindful and you investigate, you put your mindfulness on where you'll find enlightenment. But that will come later in the talk on deep insights. Next question, be quick because it's getting late. One of George Bush and Tony Blair's intention in going to Iraq war is to free the oppressed Iraqi people. Isn't that considered a good karma? It's the intention, where they're coming from might be compassionate, but they're stupid because it doesn't give anyone any freedom. Unless compassion has wisdom with it, sometimes you make big messes in this world. There was a story of a Boy Scout in England who wanted to do his one good deed of the day and took an elderly woman across the road, because it was a busy road. The trouble was the old woman didn't want to go. Is that being compassionate? Of course it isn't. You've got to be wise as well as compassionate. And there are too many problems happen in this world when people are being kind without any wisdom. They think they're doing a good thing, but they end up creating so much trouble in our world. For example, in Australia, about 30, 40 years ago, the government thought it would be much better to take the Aboriginal children away from their parents and give them a Western education. And it was called the Stolen Generation. It was a tragedy in Australia. the people would come to the Aboriginal settlements and literally take the crying children away from their mothers and fathers, because they thought it would be much better if they went to a Western type school than stay in their Aboriginal communities. Imagine that was you. In the middle of the day, these big guys came and took your children away to say, look, it's much better they come and stay with somebody else than stay with you. There are many things like that happen in our world. People think they're doing a kind thing by giving these children a good education, the start in life. But it's not wise. That created a huge problem amongst the indigenous population of Australia. Sometimes, even people think they're doing the kindest thing because they are fundamentalist Christians, to going to their father or mother's bedside when they're about to die to try and convert them. They do that out of kindness, but out of stupidity. That's a wrong thing to do. That really is evil. When somebody is dying, trying to put that type of pressure on them. My advice to you, and I remember telling this to Chief Reverend, and he thought it was a great idea. If that happens to you, you may have some relation who, you know, comes from one of these crazy churches. I like Christians, you know, the mainstream one, the Catholics and the Anglicans. I'm good friends with them. It's the fundamentalists of the problem. Like recently, I was doing an interfaith, I call it a gig. It was at a chaplain's conference in the University of Western Australia, and the morning lecture was a dialogue between myself, the abbot of a Buddhist monastery, and Abbot Placid, the Catholic Benedictine abbot. And one of the questions asked, because we get on really well, one of the audience, who was a broadcaster in the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, also a chaplain, an Anglican, he said that in the universities where he's a chaplain, it's so easy to get on with the Hindus, with the Jews, with the Catholics, with the Anglicans and the Buddhists. He said the ones he has all the trouble with are the Pentecostals. Even as a Christian, he can't get on with those. And he asked the abbot, the Catholic abbot, what's your advice? And the abbot said, take them out one by one. That's what he said. It made me really hit with laughter. And he said, we all have trouble with those. The mainstream Christians have trouble with those Pentecostals. So I told the Chief Reverend, I said, my advice to my disciples, if some of these crazy people come to your bedside when you're about to die and ask you to convert to Christianity, convert to being a Christian. Please convert. And then they'll be so happy they will leave, and they will leave you alone. As soon as they're out the door, convert back to being a Buddhist. You can convert one way, you can convert back again, can't you? At least it gets rid of them, because they won't leave you alone until you say, I'm a Christian. And they can convert back when they left, and then they leave you alone. Anyway, that's kindness without wisdom. That's a problem. Out of curiosity, why are monks allowed to ordain and disrobe as many as 7 times, but nuns are only allowed once? Who said they're only allowed once? You can ordain 7 times if you like as a nun. Because I'm so kind, I allow you 8 times. So that's not true. You're allowed to be a nun as many times as you want. Reflect on the issue. What's this? Front page. In a real-life working environment, you are asked by your boss for an answer to a complex problem by the next day. But you need time to research on the issues before coming up with a good solution. How can you tell the boss you need time to slow down? 2, reflect on the issues before coming up with a good answer. How can you tell the boss that he himself needs to slow down to be mindful of the issues involved? You stand to be labelled as a slow worker. How do you handle this? You tell him to come to one of Ajahn Brahm's talks. You give him a CD for Christmas present, or even better, package up, open the door of your heart and say, here boss, happy Christmas. eventually your boss learns, but if you are an efficient worker, your boss knows that. He knows how well you work. But if you are slow or if you're fast, as long as you get the work done well. Because the boss sometimes is in a bit of a bind, and sometimes that he or she will sometimes forget it, but sometimes they don't realize what they're doing. So be kind to the boss, but don't let your boss control your schedule. Say yes, boss, and just do it in your own time. Kindly give some tips on how to motivate a depressed person to get out of the apathetic state he is in. Tell him to enjoy his depression. What a wonderful thing is to being depressed. You don't have to go to work in the morning. You can sleep in. Oh, what a wonderful thing. Most people enjoy their depression. Because they're enjoying it, they don't get depressed anymore. Use reverse psychology. But also, sometimes a depressed person, if you are jolly and happy, you don't get depressed about seeing your friend depressed. You're actually feeding them some energy. So go into their room and wear your Hawaiian shirt. Wear a funny hat. Put a red nose on you and do an Irish jig in front of their bedside. Apparently there was a movie about this doctor. What was it called? Oh, Patch Adams, yes. And that's what he did. He just was completely crazy and did weird things, and actually people got much better, and it cured their depression, because when they're very sick you feel so terrible. And it was a real life person who went sort of making people have fun because he had fun. So go and get a clown suit and wear it to the temple, or what, I don't know. And give some energy, and you have energy, and it's infectious. And maybe that might help them. Venerable sir, I want to do my homework, but cannot. I just want to do other things, like play the piano, go on the internet, chat with friends. How can I solve this problem on behalf of my son? Okay, is that really what your son wants? So if he really wants to do his homework, sometimes make the homework enjoyable. That's one of the problems of teachers. Sometimes they don't know how to put fun into their lessons. Once I set an examination as a school teacher on mathematics, and I put a joke in the exam paper. I did. That was in, 1972, I think, or 3, before I became a monk. 73. I died in 74. So I put this joke in a maths exam for, I think it was the fifth form, so just the year before O-levels, fourth form, that's right. And when I submitted the exam paper, I thought the headmaster would catch that and reprimanded me, but I thought I'd give it a try. And he read it, and he called me into his office, and he said, "Well done, what a great idea." So it was printed out, and I always remember, it was like a hall like this. And I, because I was the invigilator, I set the exam. I had to sit up here and get all the kids to come in with the exam paper upside down on the desk with a clock. Sit down, no talking. And they said, "When I tell you, you can turn the exam papers up, you have an hour and a half. When I say stop, put your pencils down, I'll collect the papers." It was serious, exam time at the end of the year. So I looked at all these kids, some were in my class, some were other classes, and even though it wasn't O-level yet, the poor children were so nervous. You could see them, they weren't enjoying this at all. Have you ever seen kids going into an examination? It's like going into the dentist, or going to be executed. And so they turned up their papers, and I was looking, and I was waiting till they got to my question. When they got to my question, one by one they looked at me, and I smiled at them, they smiled back. They got the joke, and they relaxed. So they did well in those examination papers. It was a great psychological ploy, which worked. Because when you're doing examination papers, you're so tense you can't do them well. But when you have a joke, it relaxes you. It's not such a serious thing. Look at exams anyway. You have to keep on doing them until you eventually fail one. And then you don't have to do them anymore. It's much better to fail them early and have a good time. It's true, if you keep passing, there's another one you have to do. So when you make it fun, people like doing their homework. So the job of a teacher is to make the homework fun. And for kids to choose courses, not what their parents want them to do, but what they enjoy. I was talking to a kid a couple of days ago in Perth. I think it was a 12-year-old. What are you doing in school? Oh, no, a 14-year-old. What are you going to major in? Fashion. Her school teaches her fashion design. She loves it. Why do we have to just have chemistry or geography? Can you get a job as a geographer? You can sometimes, but you get more jobs like fashion design. That's a big industry. So they're training these kids in this school. It's a great school, very progressive. They also train kids who want to be pilots as well, when they're 14 or 15. They realize in real life, knowing English or maths is important, but if you've got a flair like in fashion design, we're going to take you on and teach you how to design things. Get on the machine and make it, wear it. Because, you know, kids are very fashion conscious and they're also innovative. What a wonderful thing is to take a 14-year-old who's got a flair in that area and give them resources. She loves her homework. You don't have to force her to do her homework. So when you actually tailor courses for passions which are really going to create a good career, well, it's easy to do. Half the problem lies in the school. They're too far behind the times. They're not training a child for life, for a good career. They're just doing what ordinary people have done for years, which sometimes doesn't work. Does celibacy improve a clearer mind and purity of the mind? Sure it does, because how many people spend time thinking about sex? There was research done in the United States saying when people listen to a talk, this was in conferences, he said 95% of the time they're thinking sexual fantasies. That's what it said in the United States. I hope that's not what you've been doing for the last 2 hours. So it just simplifies things. You don't have to think about sex. And it also means, because I've been a monk for 32 years, now you all trust me now. So sometimes even young girls can come and talk about their sexual problems with me. Which they can't do that to anybody else. Because I am not in the game. In any sport you have to have the referee or umpire. If that referee is playing for one side or the other, they can't be a good referee. So I'm not playing for the girls, I'm not playing for the men. I'm an umpire. That's why in Thailand there are three genders. Male, female and monks. And you can only do that if you're celibate. So celibacy gives me a great advantage. And I know that many women have told me that when they come and talk to me, they feel they can talk to me about things they can't talk to another person about. They can't talk to another woman. They can't talk to another man. But they talk to a monk. It's like talking to a person who's not going to be a sexual object, who's not regarding them as a possible partner. And because of that, there's a freedom there of talking with a monk. So that's why that monks make great counselors. Because they are umpires, they're not part of the sexual game. And you know how much, you know, sex, relationships, sort of obsess our world. Sometimes people say it's all about sex, all about relationships. It's not, but a lot of it is. And it's great having somebody outside of that who can give you a good objective opinion. So it's wonderful having a few celibate people around. And could a lay person live a celibacy life and how it's against nature and not acceptable in society? Celibacy is becoming acceptable. You have a choice. If you really want to, you can. It's up to you. Sometimes people are celibate for a while and then they sort of go back to a sexual relationship. That's fine. It's your choice. You don't have to follow what other people do. And many people make that as their life choice. So it's up to you. You're free to do so. And in modern society, it's acceptable. It's only difficult when you're young, especially a woman, because your parents can't wait to have grandchildren. They're masochists. They've just got rid of you and they want some more. But if not that, sometimes the other, you can become celibate. It's 10 o'clock now, so we've got quite a few questions left, but it's a bit late. So, tomorrow? Okay, we'll do it tomorrow. So the questions which aren't answered here, amazing questions. Wow, you'd be really missing out if you don't listen to these answers. So you have to come tomorrow. So, okay. Okay, so let's share merits before we finish. Are you ready? Here we go. Idame. Idame nyati nang hotu sukita hontu yatayo. Idame nyati nang hotu sukita hontu yatayo. Idame nyati nang hotu sukita hontu yatayo. Three Ajahn Brahm sadhus. Sadhu.
Sadhu.
Very good. Okay, enjoy your evening and see many of you tomorrow. I'm just going to go down there. If anyone wants to say anything personally, I'll be here for a while. Yeah. Oh, you want to say last words? Go on.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for the most inspiring talk. Tomorrow's talk is on overcoming obstacles. So, see you tomorrow.